This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated July 5th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's first story, Top of the Fold, Special Bond Law Used Once Appears Dead, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. This article is from Hillsborough. North Carolina finally found its guinea pig for a new law passed in 2008 that allows towns and cities to negotiate with private real estate developers to help pay for roads, bridges, and infrastructure work. Hillsborough town leaders recently approved a resolution that would allow for the issuance of $5.1 million in bonds to pay for a new road and the completion of a town park in the $300 million Waterstone development project near where UNC Hospitals is building its new Hillsborough Hospital campus. But Hillsborough may be the only municipality that gets to test out the law, known as special assessments. That's because the law expired on July 1st. A Senate bill that passed in mid-May that would extend the special assessment law through July 2015 had not found a consensus in the state House of Representatives as of July 3rd. Right now, Hillsborough is the first and only in state history, says Mac Paul, a lawyer with Morningstar Law Group who represented the owner of Waterstone, Stanford Land of Dallas, Texas. Under the law, Hillsborough will be able to sell up to $6.2 million in bonds levied against the value of the Waterstone property to pay for the extension of Cates Creek Parkway through the center of the property, for the completion of a town park at the site, and for payment on 2 years' worth of debt on the property and other expenses related to the bond. The bond would be paid back within the next 10.5 years using proceeds from a property tax on the Waterstone acreage and developments. Waterstone encompasses 330 acres along Old NC 86 between Interstate 40 and Interstate 85. Durham Technical Community College opened a satellite campus at Waterstone in 2008. UNC Hospitals broke ground on its $200 million Hillsborough Hospital campus on Waterstone Drive in 2011, and the Little School operates a preschool, but most of the other construction at Waterstone was halted during the recession. Waterstone's master plan also allows for future development of 129 single-family homes, 122 townhomes, 572 multifamily units and 580,000 square feet of office, retail, and hotel buildings, plus a future fire station site. O.C. Vest, Senior Vice President of Stratford Land, says the Hillsborough Special Assessment Bond is crucial for the project to move forward. The commercial banks were not lending on infrastructure for raw land, so it would have been very difficult to move the project forward without the district, he says, noting that Stratford has several projects across the nation that utilize different forms of special assessment and special taxing districts that are similar to the Waterstone Special Assessment District. Hillsborough Town Manager Eric Peterson says the special assessment district agreement with Stratford wasn't without debate. Twice during negotiations, Peterson says he recommended the town council not approve the assessment for Waterstone. What they were proposing was too much money for too much risk, he says. I'm supportive of the instrument, but it's not right in all cases. Peterson says the town ultimately reached a deal with Stratford because the developer agreed to not use the funds for the project that had already been completed. That was the tipping point, Peter says. This way makes the developers and future property owners pay for the development and not make everyone else in the town pay for it. Peterson says he believes the compromise will be a win-win for the town and the developers. Nobody has done one in North Carolina, so we're plowing new ground here. Now for this week's lead article, The Checks in the Air. Large banks getting a leg up as customers embrace the latest in banking, mobile. By Lee Weisbecker. This article comes to you from Raleigh. smartphones are dividing the banking industry into haves and have-nots. In a practice now catching fire, iPhone and Android users are able to snap photographs of the fronts and backs of checks they receive and transmit those images to a bank. The bank then deposits the sum into the customer's account. It's called mobile, or remote deposit or capture. Immediately recognizing the revolutionary nature of the development, big banks, the haves, rushed in to make the technology and administrative changes needed to embrace the practice. Many have even been offering the feature free of charge. But don't expect that to last. Meanwhile, smaller, regional, and community banks have been slower to respond, relegating themselves, perhaps, into the non-competitive status of have-nots. To believe a major split in the industry is taking place, one has to agree with the idea that mobile transactions are going to be a big deal. And the scattered data available on mobile banking suggests that a ground shift indeed is underway. At Pittsburgh-based PNC Financial, for example, iPhones and Android devices now deliver about 15,000 checks a day, up by 230% over the past 12 months. And the volume of remote captures is growing at the rate of 700 checks a day, says Tom Treblecock, PNC's head of e-banking. I'd say a fourth of our visits are now mobile, he says, and we are talking about millions of visits. At Charlotte-based Bank of America, also an early adopter of remote capture, total mobile accounts increased by 31% from 9.1 million to 12 million between 2011 and 2012. Meanwhile, simple old hat online banking, where the customer sits down at a PC to pay a bill or check his or her balance, was actually on the decline during the same period, from 29.9 million accounts in 2011 to 29.6 million in 2012. Clearly, it's the mobile methodology that is a dynamic element in the industry. It lets people bank where they want, when they want, is how Kristen Rankin, mobile channel manager at Atlantic-based SunTrust, describes it. At last count, Rankin says 49% of all SunTrust online customers are mobile, remote depositors. Thus far, SunTrust, PNC, Bank of America, and Winston-Salem-based BB&T have been offering customers a suite of mobile transactions at no charge. But the ground is shifting on that front as well. A few major players have started charging for various types of mobile transactions. U.S. Bank, among the first to do so, tacks a 50-cent fee on a remote check capture. Birmingham, Alabama-based Regions charges a fee depending on how fast the mobile depositor wants the money to become available. 50 cents per check on a wait of 2 business days, up to 3% of the deposit amount for immediate availability. Other banks heretofore in the free column are taking a second look at the issue. Among them is PNC, whose new CEO, William Demchak, has begun describing the bank's mobile options as a value-added service. Asked if those comments suggest a slate of fees is on the way, a bank spokesman responded, "We are constantly evaluating our products and services, and PNC is not announcing any new fees at this time. All decisions are made only after careful consideration of customer needs and the value produced." So much for the haves. What of the have-nots? Included in the category are not just smaller community banks. Raleigh-based First Citizens' initial response to mobile was a suite of services that allowed users to monitor their accounts and move cash between them. The third major leg of the stool, remote deposit from a smartphone, is coming in the fall, says bank's spokeswoman Barbara Thompson. "That was planned all along and is not tied to our technology upgrade," adds Thompson, referring to a $100 million 3-year tech overhaul the bank has launched, but not detailed. One emerging regional banking operation, Raleigh-based Vantage South, now with a branch network stretching from Salisbury to the coast, doesn't plan to be left behind. It is currently ramping up its technical capabilities, including remote deposit. "And the rough date is later this summer before we are fully operational," says bank's spokeswoman Blair Kennedy. The smaller community banks, for the most part, don't have mobile deposit capability. Their business clients for years have been able to make remote deposits using desktop image scanners that link their companies to the banks. The new mobile wave isn't expected to upset the apple cart, since it's doubtful that business customers would want to make the effort of photographing multiple checks by hand. Even so, the mobile technology gaps facing the smaller banks threaten to leave them a step behind in the race for new retail customers. We haven't jumped into mobile banking, though competitive pressure will likely force us to do so at some point soon, says John Anthony, executive vice president of Raleigh-based Trust Atlantic. Not many other local banks have pulled the trigger on that I'm aware of, he says. It is not so much software and other technical costs that are putting a damper on small bank entry, says Anthony. Indeed, the price of ramping up can be less than $10,000 plus monthly fees. What's giving the smaller banks the jitters, he says, are the intangible and administrative expenses that come with moving to mobile deposit, plus a healthy respect for security issues involved. And we would need to mitigate those risks by ensuring that we have the staff and expertise to monitor the transactions and volumes for unusual behavior and to monitor the system security to prevent hacker breaches, he says. 2 years ago, only 18% of community banks nationwide offered any sort of mobile banking services to customers. That figure had climbed to 37% by late 2012, according to the Washington-based Independent Community Bankers of America. This side note, the mobile menu includes downloading a mobile application on a smartphone so bank customers can check balances, pay bills, or transfer cash from savings to checking, and vice versa. They can deposit checks, they can locate branches and ATMs, and they can contact customer service. Also, 24% of mobile users rated mobile banking as very safe. 52% of mobile users rate mobile banking as somewhat safe. Next up, Branches Could Change and Fade Away by Lee Weisbecker. Continuing on the subject of mobile banking, this article comes to you from Raleigh. Will online and mobile banking polish off bricks and mortar bank branches that seem to populate every urban corner? Probably not anytime soon, but as e-banking grows, it's a good bet that banks will be scaling back on office numbers and building fewer branches along traditional lines anyway. Without drawing any elaborate conclusions, Bank of America illustrated this trend in a section of its most recent annual report. Mobile banking customers increased by $2.8 million customers in 2012. And the bank reports reflecting changes in our customers' banking preferences. In the very next sentence of the report, the writers then related how the branch numbers had declined by 224, while ATMs have been cut by 1,409 as we continue to improve our cost to service and optimize our consumer banking network. The rise of e-banking, in other words, is already prompting some cuts and tucks in the terms of bricks and mortar. At Pittsburgh-based PNC Financial, only 20% of customers now rely on a branch office as their primary contact. Meanwhile, 34% say virtual access is their first choice, and 46% say they rely on both. With mobile depositing becoming more widespread, the question is how many customers in that 46% group will begin to curtail or cut their visits to a branch office to perform rudimentary banking functions. Loan applications calling for a lot of data entry don't readily lend themselves to smartphones, says PNC e-banking head Tom Treblecock. Even so, PNC does take loan applications from customers who access the bank on desktops, laptops, and similar devices. Online in some form or another, in other words, is also becoming an avenue to accomplish many not-so-rudimentary banking activities, a fact that prompts Treblecock to remark, "We see it, e-banking, as the future." For San Francisco-based Wells Fargo, there is a middle ground, as evidenced by Wells' decision in April to open its version of the branch office of the future on a street in Washington, D.C. The branch, painted a bright yellow inside, is roughly a fourth the size of a traditional branch. Teller stations have been replaced by computer tablets and self-service kiosks, line the walls. There is no vault, since all the cash resides in the ATMs. The staffers who are on hand roam around with computer tablets in hand. The Wells Fargo vision of the banking future reduces physical size and staffing, and therefore cost, down to the bare essentials. But at this point, the Washington experiment remains just that, a single prototype in Wells Fargo's traditional branch network of 6,200 stores stretching across the country. Moving inside the front cover, transit backers find hope in new funding formula. By Chris Bagley. This article comes from Raleigh. Saying they are heartened by a last-minute amendment to the transportation bill that Governor Pat McCrory signed on June 26th, public transit advocates are eager to push for money from reorganized funding streams. The new law divides funds for transportation projects, with 40% allocated to statewide projects, 30% to regional projects, and 30% to local projects, compared to a 50-25-25 split before. The 30% share available for multi-county projects like the Triangle's proposed network of three light and commuter rail lines could be a modest gain from the 25% that otherwise might have been available. It's still up to the Department of Transportation to lay out the criteria it will use for prioritizing new projects, and the devil could be in the details. State Senator Josh Stein, who represents parts of Western Wake County and worked on the bill as a Senate Finance Committee member, says he intends to stay in touch with DOT's senior management to ensure that the criteria take account of the public transit. The criteria are likely to be similar to those used for prioritizing projects for the last few years, which include improvements in safety and economic impact, the official in charge of the agency's prioritization said just after the June 26 signing. There may be some slight differences, but no dramatic differences, says Don Volker, who heads the department's Strategic Planning Office of Transportation. A draft of the Senate's version of the bill would have kept transit projects from competing for money from the regional pools, leaving only the local divisional pools. The Department of Transportation has 7 regions and 14 divisions. At the urging of several senators from urban areas, the bill was amended to open the regional money to transit projects, thus matching the version in the House of Representatives. If they weren't able to access regional money, it was probably going to be impossible to fund transit, Stein says. Karen Rendage, executive director of the advocacy group Wake Up Wake County, says she aims to keep the issue in the public eye until it's put before the county voters. Voters in Orange and Durham counties already have approved the additional half-cent sales tax needed to fund their portions of the three rail lines and expanded bus service. Wake County commissioners could put the question to the voters as soon as November 2014. This week's column by Amanda Hoyle is about commercial and real estate for the residents. This article is about Harnett's new tack on economic development. The county commissioners and the new county manager in Harnett County have decided to take a different approach to recruiting businesses, beginning by eliminating the 3 positions in its economic development department. That decision wasn't apparent to the public until an announcement on June 27 that the Rooms to Go Furniture Company would invest $40 million to build a distribution center and retail showroom in Harnett County, a project that is expected to create 220 jobs in Dunn. Missing from the list of county and state leaders lauded for their help in recruiting the project was Phyllis Owens, the director of Harnett County Economic Development Commission since 2009. It turns out that Owens, her assistant director Cindy Minter, and the administrative assistant Cheryl Womack had been terminated 2 weeks prior to the Rooms to Go announcement, with little or no warning that their positions were being unfunded. "We had a really tough budget year again, and we had to make some sacrifices in the county," says Joseph Jeffries, Harnett County deputy county manager, who will be assuming many of Owens' duties. "Economic development is still a priority, but we are trying to approach it in a different way." Jeffrey says that for now, he, County Manager Tommy Burns, and Planning Services Director Mark Locklear will share the duties of the county's Economic Development Department. The estimated annual savings is $302,000. Also in this week's column about commercial and residential real estate are historic homes for sale. There are several historic properties in the Triangle that were built prior to 1900 and that have been lovingly cared for and are either currently listed for sale or have recently been sold to new owners. 2314 St. Mary's Road in Hillsboro was built in 1750. The asking price is $2.15 million. At 219 Hardscrabble Drive in Hillsboro, that home was built in approximately 1775 to 1790, and it was seamed together in 1888. That asking price is $795,000. In Raleigh, 411 North Budworth Street, built in about 1871, and it's for sale at $785,000. And 6849 Cornwallis Road in Garner, built in 1875, asking price $6.3 million, and this comes with 174 acres. $2.25 million with just 10 acres. And for countywide building permits in Wake County, the number issued is an indication of future construction. It rose by 5% in Wake County in May for all residential and commercial projects compared to the year prior. The value of all permits increased by 22% in May. As for Durham County building permits, the number of building permits issued in Durham County in May declined by 10% for all residential and commercial projects compared to the year prior, but the value of all permits more than doubled with 113% growth. Most of the growth was due to more than $70 million in commercial building renovation and expansion projects recorded in May. Next up, Chris Bagley and his column on transportation, law, and energy. This week's article is Law Aims to Help Unclog Courts. Cases for small claims court will rise from $5,000 to the threshold of $10,000. Fewer lawsuits are likely to end up in superior court and more in lower courts as a result of a law that takes effect August 1st. Sponsored by State Senator Tom Goolsbee, an attorney from the Wilmington area, the law raises the threshold dollar amounts that separate the three types of trial courts from one another. Small claims court will be able to take lawsuits involving less than $10,000. Plaintiffs can file a lawsuit in North Carolina District Court if it involves less than $25,000, and larger cases are to be filed in Superior Court. District courts move more quickly through cases and have shorter backlogs than Superior Court, attorneys say. That could speed up the process of collecting consumer debts for banks and other lenders, including credit card companies, as well as businesses in dispute over relatively small debts, says John Sperati, a creditor-sided attorney with Smith Debnam in Raleigh. A case can still be transferred from one to the other if neither party objects, Sperati notes, and the two courts have similar rules. At the lower end of the spectrum, the maximum for small claims courts is rising to $10,000 from $5,000. That's expected to allow individuals to take more cases to court without having to hire an attorney, given those courts' simpler rules. It will empower people to handle their own cases, Goolsbee says. Other legislation expected to authorize 35 new magistrates to hear small claims cases. Unlike judges in Superior Court and District Court, magistrates need not be licensed attorneys. UNC Chapel Hill law professor Erica Wilson says she hopes the lower courts won't be jammed up by the larger cases coming in. Wilson supervises the school's civil clinic, which litigates cases for clients who can't pay, including large numbers of cases in small claims court and district court. Next up, Lauren K. Onisorge, columns on infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. This week's article is called Call These Bugs Biobots. North Carolina State University researchers discovering ways to steer cockroaches for rescue work. It sounds like something out of the Old Testament. A swarm of insects heading your way, except instead of bringing forth a plague, they're bringing in the cavalry. Sort of. The insects are what NC State University researcher Alper Boskert calls biobots, controlled by computer steering. And the goal? To create a versatile search and rescue tool. Boskert and team have incorporated Microsoft's motion-sensing kinetic system into an electronic interface that can remotely control the cockroaches. The theory is the cockroaches could be placed on autopilot to map dynamic environments such as collapsed buildings. People have been trying to build synthetic robots for that, but there are a lot of technical issues, explained Boskert. Issues such as unreliable environments, mechanical breakage, and power source problems. There could be wind or predators, he says. And Boskert has witnessed the chaotic search and rescue efforts firsthand. A native of Turkey, he watched in horror as family scrambled through the rubble of a devastating earthquake in 1999. It's an experience that stayed with him when he emigrated to the United States, and it's something he drew on when he started researching bionic insects and brainstorming applications. Insects are perfect candidates, he says, noting that not only can cockroaches travel in extremely small spaces, but they're also plentiful. And CSU has 20 different species of roaches. With the simplicity of their neurological systems, they're an ideal match for the biobot technology. It's sort of a domesticated animal. We have horses, oxen, elephants, even dogs. We tell them to do stuff, and they do it. Using technology to guide them isn't that far of a stretch, Boskert says. Propelled by a 3-year National Science Foundation grant, he thinks his team will be ready to move to the next step in 2 years. And that next step? Bringing the technology to real-life scenarios. He expects the bionic roaches to cost just a few dollars each and intends a swarm to be released on a rescue situation. But researchers are starting small, having just demonstrated an insect biobot's ability to follow a line drawn on the ground. By testing the roaches' responses, Boskert can improve the technology and create an automated platform, like Autopilot. So far, his 4-person team has nabbed about $1 million in grant funding, and with the next financial round, could be another step closer to saving lives, he says. Jeff Roberts, who heads the training division at the Durham Fire Department, says the status quo for his department in the event of a building collapse is using sound equipment to figure out where the victims are located. A camera is then lowered into the area. This week's spotlight is on entrepreneurs, and this article is entitled Sporting Life Becomes a Business Life by Lauren K. Onisores from Durham. Jennifer Oldham isn't just an entrepreneur, she's a fighter, literally. The CEO of a hidden Broad Street treasure, Mid-South Fencers Club, Oldham has transformed her love of the sport into a Durham business. Oldham, who fenced competitively at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, has signed on about 150 members and is set to more than double her space, moving into a new locale in the Brightleaf District. But her entrepreneurship story didn't happen overnight. It started out of the back of my van, she says. Originally, the club was based at the Sports National Training Center in Portland, Oregon, which is where she worked before moving. I had my first child and didn't want to raise my children so far away with my family, she says. That's why she moved back to her native North Carolina to teach, finding what she lovingly refers to as the basement, a space underneath a coffee shop and funeral home at Broad Street. 5 years ago, the center became a reality based on self-financing and credit card debt. At that time, there were 18 members. It was a risk, but one that is taking off. Since founding the club, Oldham has produced national performance-oriented results, such as the success of wheelchair fencer Mia Ives Rubley, a U.S. wheelchair team athlete about to leave for competition in Budapest. I think the fact that they're even willing to try out adapted athletics and let me participate is huge, Ives Rubley says. Additionally, the club has more than 20 USA fencing national medalist, and has just landed a new coach and former Olympian, Jacek Hukwaka, who is also an assistant coach at Duke University. We have evolved into offering not only competitive training opportunities, but beginner classes, birthday parties, office parties, she says. The business plan evolved to serve some needs. And it's evolving without any advertising dollars. Oldham credits the success to partnerships with area schools such as Cary Academy. By creating after-school programs, word is getting out. Oldham literally knocked on school doors to nab those deals. The growth in the past 5 years has been tremendous, she says. We're planning for large growth, and now the challenge is, how do we do what we've done, well, better? Servicing more people in more ways. The new location will help, and in July, Oldham plans to launch a crowdfunding campaign on funding site Indiegogo, seeking $10,000 but hoping to get as much as $30,000 to buy new equipment. Crowdfunding is not just a funding mechanism, it's also a way to get the community involved and excited about her business. And she's aiming to open the new location on October 1st. This week's Small Business Focus is the Resolute Building Company. This article is by Thompson Wall. Chapel Hill Company resolutely charges through tough times. From Chapel Hill. North Carolina's construction industry was hammered by the Great Recession and only has begun to rebound. And the aptly named Resolute Building Company is proving that a little strategy goes a long way in working its way through a troubled economy. Founded in 1984, the Resolute Building Company is a regional commercial general contractor based in Chapel Hill, known for undertaking projects like East 54, the North Carolina State Bar headquarters, and the upcoming expansion to Durham's luxurious West Village Apartments. With $43 million in gross billings in 2012, Resolute was the Triangle's 13th largest general contractor last year. The company's founder and former CEO, Dave Anna, holds a degree in architecture from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and maintains his license in both New York and North Carolina. From a developer's point of view, Anna's architectural background is a vital leg up on the competition. The Resolute Building Company is dependable, yet at the same time they're also very creative, says Roger Perry, president of East West Partners Management Company, which collaborated with Resolute on Chapel Hill's East 54 mixed-use development. They figure out better, cheaper ways to do things. They work collaboratively with architects and generally do an outstanding job. Before the recession, Resolute's business consisted of 90% negotiated work, meaning jobs on which a contractor is specifically selected, often due to past success in other projects. Negotiated contracts save both parties time and money while enabling developers to choose contractors based on the quality of their work, among other factors. But the landscape for business changed for the most general contractors during the recession. Resolute now contracts just 10% negotiated work and 90% public bid work. And competition for public bid projects is fiercer than ever, resulting in meager profit margins and a serious risk of subcontractor failure. Hesitancy by private owners to commit to new construction, along with continuing shrinkage in public budgets, will keep the recovery weaker than it otherwise would be, says Ken Simonson, chief economist for the Associated General Contractors of America. According to the association, North Carolina lost 6,000 construction sector jobs in the past year, the second highest of any state. Construction employment in North Carolina peaked at June 2007 with 256,800 industry employees. As of May 2013, only 166,800 of those jobs remained, a 35% decrease, or 90,000 jobs. But the state's general contractors are beginning to see better days, thanks in part to a state budget allocation of $300 million for repairs and renovations involving state and UNC system buildings. Additional legislation has been introduced that would provide $480 million in funding for UNC construction projects. A potential $900 million bond referendum for Wake County Schools, the largest school system in the Carolinas, would also help stimulate construction work and boost the region's economy. As for Resolute, renewed momentum in residential construction is helping. The company won a negotiated contract, its first in more than 4 years, to renovate Durham's West Village Apartments. But perhaps Resolute's most promising asset is its vice president turned CEO, Joe Hatcher, who took command of the company in May. Armed with nearly 30 years of experience in the commercial construction industry, Hatcher will oversee the company's current projects, which include Highland Middle School in Harnett County, the UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor's Residence Addition, and the West Village apartment renovations. This week's Legal Focus by Jim Verdonik asks, Mr. Lincoln, who needs law schools? Schools of law pumping out more grads than positions available. Did you know that law schools are having trouble recruiting students? Lots of young people are deciding not to borrow another $100,000 on top of their undergraduate loans, especially when many recent law graduates are unemployed or underemployed. Law schools used to be refuges for students in recessions. If there aren't jobs when you graduate college, hide in law school for 3 years. By that time, the job market will improve. There's always room for more lawyers, but times have changed. The market for young lawyers is only marginally better than in 2009. Law schools that added too many seats during economic boom times have been producing more lawyers than the market needs. If the market doesn't need so many young lawyers, why shouldn't young people ask, who needs law schools? Let's run with that question. Who needs law schools? And why? Let's start answering these questions by remembering that law schools are a recent innovation. America's two most famous lawyers, Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln, didn't go to law school. You remember them, don't you? They have big memorials on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Have law schools produced better lawyers? Before you answer, let's take a quick look at Jefferson's and Lincoln's work product. Quote, unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, end quote. Quote, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, end quote. The Declaration of Independence was nothing more than a legal brief. Jefferson was arguing in the court of American public opinion and world leaders in Europe why the colonists were legally entitled to independence. Most of the Declaration is an indictment of King George and the horrible things he did. Jefferson acted as both the colonist's defender and King George's prosecutor. The structure of the Gettysburg Address is less formally legal, but the legal theme is that the living owe a debt to the dead who sacrificed on the battlefield. That debt must be repaid by making sure our free nation doesn't perish. Lincoln was a simple debt collector. Okay, now answer the question whether law schools have produced better lawyers. But if great lawyers like Jefferson and Lincoln didn't graduate from law school, how were lawyers educated? Lawyers read the law in the offices of experienced lawyers. Reading the law was a type of apprenticeship like carpenters, blacksmiths, and plumbers. Jefferson's apprenticeship followed 2 years of college education in the classics. 40 years later, Lincoln's legal education was much less formal. He simply borrowed books from a lawyer, obtained a license, and became partners with the lawyer who loaned him the books. Let me end this by saying that I'm not totally against law schools. I got a good year of good education during my 3 years in law school. And that underlines one of the problems. 4 years of the undergraduate education followed by 3 years of law school. No wonder most lawyers graduate deep in debt. Jefferson and Lincoln were too smart to do that. A side note, the editor of the Triangle Business Journal notes that Mr. Verdonik obtained his law degree from the Fordham University School of Law in 1977. End note. So why erect a $100,000 barrier to the noble profession that produced Jefferson and Lincoln? Doesn't America deserve better? P.S. Google the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, which includes an online law degree, and what is purported to have the highest unemployment rate for its graduates. It should be noted that Mr. Verdonik is an attorney with Ward and Smith in Raleigh and operator of the eLearnSuccess.com and YouTube.com eLearnSuccess. This week's guest column is by Barry Smith, who is an associate editor of the Carolina Journal. His column is entitled, Breaking Down the Commerce Strategy. Governor Pat McCrory's administration is repackaging the way it performs economic development efforts, moving the function from the Department of Commerce to a nonprofit private corporation. Senate Bill 127, allowing the North Carolina Department of Commerce to contract with a nonprofit corporation to conduct economic development functions, has advanced in the General Assembly, although support for the bill was not unanimous. The nonprofit corporation's board would have 15 members, 9 of them appointed by the governor. Legislative leaders would appoint the remaining. Conflict of interest provisions aimed at preventing any member of the board from using his or her position for personal gain are part of the bill. During review in the House Commerce Committee, Commerce Secretary Sharon Decker urged members to approve the changes in law. "We can't do things the same way and expect a different result," she says. A few House members expressed reservations. Representative Joe Sam Queen, Democrat in Haywood County, said he felt the move would centralize power in Raleigh at the expense of outlying regions in the state. "Our biggest trouble in Western North Carolina is getting any attention out of Raleigh," Queen says. "Economic development functions will be dispersed across the state of North Carolina," Deckard said. "It won't all be in Raleigh." She said those functions would include the recruitment of new businesses, support for existing business in North Carolina, and help the travel and tourism industry. Representative Chris Miller, Republican of Pender County, said he opposed the switch because it continued the practice of offering incentives to new or expanding corporations. He argued that incentives force businesses that pay taxes to wind up funding their competitors. Commerce officials are hoping the nonprofit, which would not be bound by inflexible government compensation guidelines, can make it easier to retain the most productive recruiters. The proposal also divides the state into 8 geographic prosperity zones. Those zones are designed to promote interdepartmental cooperation in industry recruitment. The bill requires that the Department of Commerce, Environment and Natural Resources, and Transportation each provide 1 employee from their regional offices to serve as liaisons with other agencies and planning bodies to work towards economic development. This week's guest opinion is from Mr. Andrew Broad, who is a senior research fellow at University of North Carolina at Greensboro Center for Business and Economic Research. His column is entitled, "Our 29th Governor, Morehead's Legacy Offers Timely Reminder." Other than our nation's birthday, July 4th marked an important birthday. It's the 217th anniversary of the birth of John Motley Morehead, Greensboro resident and 29th governor of North Carolina. We see Morehead's name throughout the state, including the port town of Morehead City, other institutions including a high school and a hospital in Eden, as well as a planetarium and a scholarship program at UNC Chapel Hill, are named for him indirectly via his grandson, industrialist John Motley Morehead III. Morehead, the grandfather, was born in 1796 and grew up in Rockingham County. As a youth, he was educated in Guilford County by the renowned David Caldwell and later at the University of North Carolina. He served in the state legislature and was elected to 2 terms as governor in 1840 and 1842. Morehead is often called the father of modern North Carolina, so perhaps it's not surprising that his 19th century legacy includes some important lessons for the North Carolina economy of the 21st century. He was a visionary in 3 distinct areas: education, architecture, and transportation. He was an early supporter of public education and made it, along with support of the University of North Carolina, a theme of his first inaugural address. Quote, "It is to our common schools, in which every child can receive the rudiments of an education, that our attention should be mainly directed," end quote. Morehead was a UNC trustee for many years and was instrumental in establishing a state school for the blind in Raleigh, now named the Governor Morehead School. It was one of the first such schools in the country and the first to educate deaf and blind African-American children. Morehead also established the Edgeworth Female Seminary in Greensboro to educate young women. Morehead was the first North Carolina governor to be inaugurated in the new and current state capital. When he wanted to expand Blandwood, his home in Greensboro, he commissioned the same New York architect, Alexander Jackson Davis, who had designed the capital. The result is the lovely estate we see in downtown Greensboro, the oldest example of Italianate architecture in the U.S. and the centerpiece of Preservation Greensboro. It is transportation with which Morehead is most often associated. He understood the value of infrastructure. In the early 1800s, the poor quality of North Carolina roads and waterways meant that the state's farmers and merchants could only serve local markets. Morehead believed that sound transportation options would open up the state to greater commercial opportunities and would broaden its cultural and intellectual outlook as well. As governor, he made little headway for better transportation against the opposition of the Democrats who controlled the legislature. But in 1849, the state chartered the North Carolina Railroad, and Morehead served as its first president. The NCRR laid hundreds of miles of tracks with a terminus in Morehead City and made connections to other railroads. With better access to customers in the second half of the 19th century, farmers expanded production dramatically and manufacturers began to prosper. Morehead was a man of his time. He supported educational opportunities for women and African Americans, but owned slaves. He opposed the secession of Southern states, but served in the Confederate Congress. However, he also understood the economic and social value of investing in education and transportation. That's a vision we'd be wise to embrace once again. This week's column 9 to 5 has a few features. Durham's, the John R. McAdams Company, has altered its name to McAdams and introduced a new corporate identity and logo. We are growing in both people and capabilities, investing in new talent and services to better serve current clients and targeted sectors, says Mike Munn, McAdams president. It is important to us that our simplified name and new logo express our commitment to being modern and ambitious. Building on our great heritage, we are intent upon being bigger, better, and stronger, says company founder and chairman John McAdams. McAdams, founded in 1979, is a full-service consulting firm offering planning, engineering, stormwater management, and related services. French West Vaughan has been selected as an agency of record by Mogo Sport, creators of a flavored mouthguard for athletes. The agency is providing an integrated campaign for Mogo, including PR, social, paid media, and athlete endorsements. Mogo mouthguards are embedded with natural flavor essences without sugar, calories, or harmful chemicals for flavor that last an entire season. Wilton, Connecticut-based Mogo provides a $10,000 dental warranty with its guards. And finally, the American Library Association and the American Institute of Architects have awarded Durham architecture firm the Freelon Group with the 2013 AIA ALA Library Building Award for the design of Anacostia Neighborhood Library in Washington, D.C. The biennial award honors excellence in library design by architects licensed in the U.S. Anacostia Neighborhood Library was one of six projects selected to receive the 2013 AIA ALA Library Award. A quick glance at what's happening in the Triangle. Townsley hints at bigger seaboard station. William Peace University foresees keeping and possibly even expanding Seaboard Station as a retail center if the college wins court approval to buy it out of bankruptcy, President Deborah Townsley tells the Triangle Business Journal. Seaboard owner Gregory and Parker Incorporated has filed court documents that proposed a $20.7 million sale of the six-acre property. Townsley stopped short of committing to develop Seaboard in any particular way, but described university and shopping centers as a sort of trend in higher education. Wake Forest University owns Rinalda Village in Winston-Salem, and the University of Central Florida owns Knights Plaza in Orlando, for example. The retail space is important to us as a piece of a vibrant campus, she says. The property, just west of the university, near the intersection of Peace Street and Halifax Street, still has room for one more building, she says. It's bonkers in the market. Public companies in the Triangle have gained a staggering $7 billion in market value over the past 6 months amid a sharp recovery in investor confidence. For the Standard & Poor 500 as a whole, the first half of 2013 was the best first half since 1999, according to calculations by a Wall Street Journal blogger. That bellwether index has risen 15% in the last months. Triangle companies performed even better with a total gain of 19%. They were led by Xerum Technologies, a Raleigh-based supplier of paper products, whose $10.70 price on July 2nd represented a gain of 251% since December 31st. The company is undertaking a major restructuring, closing plants in Charlotte and Spain, and shifting their production to cheaper facilities in China. In the city of Raleigh, Gaylord signs up social help in a bid. Raleigh City Councilman Bonner Gaylord is testing out a new way to use social media, which he says is the first such program in the country, in his bid for re-election to the Raleigh City Council. Gaylord, who is also general manager of the North Hills Shopping Center for Kane Realty Corporation in Raleigh, is asking all of his friends and supporters to sign up as social media ambassadors. He says that involves ambassadors periodically sharing blog posts, links, images, or articles about his re-election campaign with their email contacts or followers on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and LinkedIn, as well as Pinterest and other social media outlets. You are not obligated to share it, of course, he says, but as we coordinate our efforts, we will help shape the debate and keep Raleigh moving forward. It looks like the future is happening at the new UNC Wilmington Center. Jim Roberts, recently appointed director of the University of North Carolina at Wilmington's new Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, says innovation isn't just in the coastal city's future, it's already happening. The facility of UNCW have some idea, the faculty of UNCW have some ideas that have been commercialized, but we need to help them get bigger contracts with bigger partners, he says. To do it, he hopes to bring statewide resources and business leaders to Wilmington, arming coastal entrepreneurs with knowledge of the fundraising process, both investing and grant writing. And on the university theme, North Carolina State University enters a new era with the College of Sciences. NC State University, on July 1st, opened its freshly consolidated College of Sciences, which now becomes the university's third largest school. Replacing the College of Physical and Mathematical Sciences, also known as PAMS, with a more comprehensive program offering, the College of Sciences will house 6 departments, 4,000 students, and 575 existing faculty members, staff, and postdoctoral researchers. Dan Solomon, former dean of PAMS, takes the helm of the new College of Sciences as the school's inaugural dean. The convergence of the sciences is the key to addressing many of the world's greatest problems in health, energy production, and environmental sustainability, said Solomon in a statement. These problems are incredibly complex, but by working together across disciplines, we improve our ability to solve them. If you like fish, you need to talk to the Aquatic Creations Group. Aquatic Creations Group in Raleigh is an aquarium design, installation, and maintenance company specializing in home and office freshwater, saltwater, and jellyfish exhibits. Owners Gil and Michelle Van Dykshuizen moved from Monterey, California 15 years ago and started their unusual business in the Triangle in 2002. The company boasts a portfolio of 150 aquariums around the Triangle and beyond, including a 10,000-gallon cylinder aquarium housed inside Research Triangle Park's United Therapeutics Corporation, known as the Big Tank. The company even cultures its own moon jellyfish and is one of the few private companies in the nation to do so. Let's take a closer look at the economy. Several series of economic data have shown the North Carolina and Triangle economies growing faster than the nation's as a whole. A couple of others leave the state looking a little less rosy. Here's a sampling of recent rankings. Number 3. In standing among fastest-growing cities since the recession. Charlotte, Greensboro, Raleigh, and Durham are among the 25 fastest-growing U.S. cities with more than 200,000 residents. The top 25 include 8 in California and 5 in Texas. Number 3, Boomtown in the U.S. the Raleigh-Cary metropolitan statistical area was boomier than any other except for Austin, Texas, and New Orleans. Number 11 in GDP growth. North Carolina's gross domestic product was $392.9 billion in 2012, representing growth of 2.7% from 2011. And number 40 in personal growth income. North Carolinians received an annualized $362.7 billion in personal income in the first 3 months of 2013. That represented a growth of about 1.8%, better than only 10 other states. And here's a list of the notable fundraisers in Triangle Tech and Biotech as of May. Overture Networks, whose headquarters is in Morrisville, has $8 million in equity. Step Leader Incorporated, headquarters in Raleigh, has $4.6 million of equity. Zift Solutions, headquarters in Durham, $1.5 million of equity. And Axial Exchange, headquarters Raleigh, and $1 million in debt. And it should be noted that Bandwidth CEO David Morken was recognized by Entrepreneurship Magazine. David Morken, a co-founder and CEO of Raleigh-based Bandwidth.com, is officially a disruptor, according to Entrepreneur Magazine. Morken receives a distinction for shaking up the wireless industry with his company's no-contract phone plan, Republic Wireless, which costs only $19 per month and relies on Wi-Fi as its primary network. Although Republic Wireless users must contend with interrupted calls stemming from a less-than-seamless Wi-Fi to cellular handoff, the article notes, Morken says the service is signing up tens of thousands of customers each month and that updated software to fix the handover issue is forthcoming. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.